This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. President Donald Trump is in Helsinki, Finland, preparing to meet his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. On the eve of those Monday talks, U.S. Ambassador to Moscow John Huntsman called the meeting important.
No state dinner, no joint statement, no deliverables that are going to be prepackaged. You don't know what's going to come out of this meeting. But what it will be is the first opportunity for these presidents to actually sit down across the table alone and then with their teams to talk about everything from meddling in the election to areas where we have some shared interests.
White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said Mr. Trump has one key objective.
There are a lot of people raising a lot of concerns about a lot of things that we could sit here and address a whole range of them. I think the president's going into this meeting determined to advance the national interest of the United States. That's what he was elected to do.
In a CBS interview, the president named the European Union among the foes of the U.S., but added that doesn't mean they're bad, but just competitors.
The EU is very difficult. I want to tell you, maybe the thing that's most difficult, don't forget, both my parents were born in EU sectors, okay? I mean, my mother was Scotland, my father was Germany, and I love those countries. I respect the leaders of those countries, but in a trade sense, they've really taken advantage of us.
In a tweet, the president of the European Council, Donald Tusk, insisted America and the EU are best friends. Anyone who calls them foes is spreading fake news. The Ethiopian and Eritrean leaders joined thousands at a concert in Addis Ababa Sunday, marking the end of a long border war. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed spoke of the importance of forgiveness, said the reconciliation is an example to the rest of Africa and the world. The former Horn of Africa adversaries declared their 20-year state of war over last Monday. This is VOA News. In southwest Syria, hundreds of rebels and their families left the city of Daraa Sunday under an evacuation agreement, while Russian-backed pro-government forces widened their most recent offensive closer to Israeli territory, attacking rebel positions in Kunaitre province. Andrew Tabler, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, said such the operation is of concern to Israel.
Israel is concerned. They're concerned specifically about the number of Iranian forces that are intermixed with that of the Assad regime. So it's interesting that this is taking place right before a summit between Putin and Trump, which is to get Iranian forces out of Syria.
Meanwhile, Syrian state media said Israeli rockets hit a Syrian military position near Aleppo, while reports suggest all YPG Kurdish fighters have evacuated the town of Manbij, part of a U.S.-Turkey agreement. In southern Iraq Sunday, protesters clashed with police. This protester said unemployment is destroying the people of Basra. The demonstrations were also about demands for better public services. Dozens were reported wounded. One report said two were killed in the town of Samawa. The unrest comes as Iraqi politicians try to forge a coalition government following May elections. In Morocco, another large rally, this one in the capital city, Rabat, against the jailing of leaders of a protest movement in the Berber region of Rif. A court last month sentenced nearly 40 people, including protest leader Nasser Zefzafi, to terms up to 20 years for organizing protests in 2016 after a fishmonger was killed while trying to recover fish confiscated by police. They were also demanding jobs and more development. A landslide in Myanmar killed at least 15 people Sunday, injuring dozens more in a northern jade mining region. Miners were buried by muddy earth from a slope that collapsed. Nicaraguan police and paramilitaries loyal to President Daniel Ortega reportedly killed 10 Sunday in the country's south. The report issued by the Nicaraguan Association for Human Rights. Months of clashes between demonstrators and pro-Ortega forces have claimed hundreds of lives. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte Sunday said five of the European countries have agreed to take about half the 450 migrants aboard two European Union boats off the Italian coast. Italy, which has taken the brunt of the migration flow from Africa and the Middle East, demands other EU nations share the burden of caring for migrants. Ending a Grand Slam drought, overcoming painful right elbow, Serbia's Novak Djokovic Sunday won his fourth Wimbledon championship, defeating Kevin Anderson in the final three sets. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, July the 16th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. France lifts the 2018 FIFA World Cup Sunday, defeating Croatia 4-2 to claim their second World Cup championship. The French team was popular among African fans for its composition, with 80% of the French team players being of African descent.
We've won, says Kebe, who has dual French and Guinean nationality. We're the champions.
BOA's Lisa Bryant on the streets of Paris, where they are celebrating the victory of the 2018 FIFA World Cup finals. In Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, thousands of people cheered as the leaders of Ethiopia and Eritrea embraced at a concert celebrating a peace deal between the two former enemies. In Zimbabwe's electoral court is this week expected to hear a case in which the country's main opposition party is challenging early voting by some police officers. Opposition parties say is part of a vote-rigging effort for the ruling ZANU-PF party.
We're voting in the absence of officials from the Zimbabwe Election Commission. They were voting in the absence of party agents and monitors. To us, this is a blatant attempt to steal this election.
Tendai Biti of the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, the leading opposition party in Zimbabwe. And five miners die after a fire breaks out in a mine in Limpopo, north of Johannesburg. Those stories plus sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Let's start with the just-concluded World Cup tournament, watched by billions of people around the world. France won the World Cup for the second time on Sunday in a 4-2 victory over Croatia in what has been called one of the most entertaining and action-packed finals for decades. In the French capital, Parisians celebrated their first World Cup trophy in two decades, and Lisa Bryant was on the streets and the bars of Paris and has this report for us.
Parisians were literally dancing in the streets and in one neighborhood plunging into a canal to celebrate their victory. Nina Kanyak summed up her feelings in one word: great.
Because we haven't won in a long time, so it's actually a really good feeling. And it's just to see, like, the mood in the street is just so nice, because we weren't expecting that. Or, I mean, I wasn't anything.
Fatoumata Kebe had a French flag draped over her shoulders as she toasted the victory with her baby. We've won, says Kebe, who has dual French and Guinean nationality. We're the champions. France's win over Croatia appeared all but certain once the French soccer team scored its third goal and then its fourth. The World Cup finals come just a day after the country marked Bastille Day, now another revolution on the soccer field. France's last title was on home soil in 1998, when many celebrating here today were not even born. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Thousands cheered in Addis Ababa Sunday as the leaders of Ethiopia and Eritrea embraced at a concert celebrating a peace deal between the two former bitter rivals. Ethiopia's reformist Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was in Eritrea last week, a month after announcing Ethiopia was finally accepting the peace treaty it signed with Eritrea in 2000, ending 2 years of war. Eritrea's longtime president reciprocated that visit, arriving Saturday in Ethiopia amid fanfare for his first visit in 22 years. And Zimbabwe's electoral court is this week expected to hear a case in which the country's main opposition party is challenging early voting by some police officers, which opposition parties say is part of vote-rigging efforts for the ruling ZANU-PF party in the July 30th polls. Sebastian Morfo reports for VOA from Harare.
Last week, Thursday, the social media was awash of police officers lining up before their bosses casting their votes. One of the police officers posted a message saying they were being forced to vote for President Emmerson Mnangagwa. That led to the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC Alliance, to say the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission was rigging for the ruling ZANU-PF party. Under Zimbabwean law, police officers can vote before election day if they will be deployed outside their constituencies on the day of the vote. Tendai Biti of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance agrees that police postal vote is legal, but only under strict conditions which the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission was not following.
Postal voting is designed to deal with the residual officers, so it is therefore impossible, unless you want to rig an election, to have thousands of people being deployed to assist in the voting exercise on the actual voting day. The Electoral Act is very clear. You make an application for the postal vote. So you can't just wake up like a phantom and then claim entitlement to a postal vote, and they were voting in the absence of officials from the Zimbabwe Election Commission. They were voting in the absence of party agents and monitors. To us, this is a blatant attempt to steal this election. And we all know that the law proscribes voting in restricted areas, in cantonment areas.
As a result, on Friday, the opposition MDC appealed to the Electoral Court to declare invalid the voting of police officers, a case which is supposed to be heard this week. Initially, the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission totally denied that police officers were secretly voting. But Priscilla Chigumba, the chairperson of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, told reporters Friday that early voting by some police officers ahead of the July 30th general election was perfectly legal.
The law does not stipulate that these are votes which are placed in ballot boxes. For instance, these are postal votes which are supposed to be exercised in secret and the ballot paper posted back to us using the various means at the disposal. There's no role for observers, there's no role for election agents, there's no role for political parties. A postal vote is exercised in secret by an applicant.
Whatever the ruling the Electoral Court will make on the application by the opposition, it is almost certain that Zimbabwe is heading for another disputed election. When President Emmerson Mnangagwa took over from Robert Mugabe last November, he said he wanted a credible election and allowed Western observers to witness the July 30th elections. However, the opposition says that is not enough. It says the ruling ZANU-PF party and security officials must stop manipulating the election body, just as they did when Mugabe was still in power. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
And still in Southern Africa, five miners died in a South African copper mine after a fire trapped the workers underground. The country's Association for Mine Workers and Construction Union say that one miner was still trapped in the Falabella Mining Company in Limpopo, north of Johannesburg. According to the union, the fire in the mine began early Sunday morning. The latest incident comes 2 months after seven miners died in a cavern at the Mashakane Gold Mine, west of Johannesburg, at the Sibanye Stillwaters Dryfontein operation. The president of the ECOWAS Commission and the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General have both pledged to strongly support the implementation of the Gambia's new National Development Plan. The flagship development blueprint of the Barrow-led government aims to thoroughly reform the security sector, revitalize the country's broken economy, and see through an inclusive process of transitional justice. From Banjul, Sene Marena gives us this update.
The visit by these two top officials of ECOWAS and the United Nations to Banjul concludes with a news briefing at the Banjul International Airport. The joint ECOWAS and UN mission to the Gambia is meant to renew the engagement of the two organizations to support the new government's efforts towards sustaining peace and national development.
And this mission really was to continue the dialogue that we have with the Gambian authorities. You know, Gambia has been through some difficult time, and with the support of ECOWAS and the UN and other partners. The country is emerging now, and I think we have seen that there has been progress in various areas.
During their visit to Banjul, Jean-Claude Cassibrou, ECOWAS president, and Mohamed Ibn Chambers, the special representative of the UN Secretary General and the head of UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel, held discussion with President Adama Barrow, the Speaker of the National Assembly, economic mission, civil society, and international organizations. At the news conference, both officials, who have been closely following the Gambia's political and socio-economic situation, underlined the importance of safeguarding the progress and gains achieved so far. The two officials also encouraged Gambians to work together in consolidating peace.
How do we continue to support the Gambian authorities in putting in place a mechanism for follow-up to ensure that all the promises that were made in Brussels are realized? Reinforce the dialogue on some key issues. We discuss issues relating to the reform of the security sector, which is an important element.
The new Minister of Foreign Affairs, Dr. Momodou Tangara, said the visit by the UN and ECOWAS demonstrate government commitment to strengthen its relation with the international community.
The Gambia has a special place, and the focus is on the Gambia. We all want for Gambia to succeed.
These visits are basically to solidify the partnership that we have with the Gambia. And also, the Gambia is one of the UN Secretary General's pilot for the Sustaining Peace Agenda.
Seni Marena, VOA News, Banjul.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. And consultations are set to take place this week for the resumption of the inter-Burundi dialogue to put an end to the political crisis that erupted in 2015. The European Parliament has also criticized the Burundi government for a lack of willingness to engage in the regional mediated dialogue. From Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, Moses Havyarimana has more on this.
The East African Community Inter-Burundi Dialogue is expected to resume as the facilitation team will meet this week. The former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa, who is the facilitator, is expected to meet the Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, who is the mediator, to agree on the way forward. Ken Vitisha is the Kenyan ambassador to Burundi and a member of the facilitation team.
The facilitation team will meet next week in Arusha and prepare a roadmap for consultations with all stakeholders, with the UN and AU, to agree on a roadmap and arrangements for the fifth session.
The regional mediated dialogue that was launched 2 years ago is yet to be fruitful, as Burundi government said that it will not dialogue with those it accuses of plotting the 2015 failed coup. The International Conference on Great Lakes Region, ICGLR Parliamentarians Forum, ended this week a three-day visit to Burundi to assess the situation on the ground, where they met the representatives of the Burundi Parliament. Agathon Rwasa is an opposition leader and the deputy speaker of the Burundi Parliament.
All what I can say is that we assume that there are some positive involvement of the situation with regard to what happened in 2015. Nevertheless, there are still things to be done. There is a need to conclude with the external dialogue led by the facilitator Benjamin Mkapa.
Recently, the Burundi ruling party, CNDD FDD, called on the mediator to finalize the dialogue, that all politicians inside and outside the country to get involved in peace-building process. Evariste Ndayishimiye is the secretary general of the ruling party. He says that he calls upon Burundian mediator to help sign the communique of the recent round of talks that took place in Arusha, so as Burundians can easily implement the new constitution that themselves amended. Opposition leaders in the country expresses their concerns on the new constitution that was amended even before the dialogue concludes, reiterates Mr. Rwasa as an opposition leader.
The current constitution is a little bit unbalanced, where some people seem to be excluded as they are submitted to some conditions very hard to meet. especially those who are in the category of independence. Normally, a constitution won't be a source of problems.
As the regional mediated dialogue consultation is expected to resume this week, European Parliament released a resolution regretting the slow pace of the inter-Burundian dialogue and the lack of commitment of the Burundian government. The Parliament urged the urgent resumption of the dialogue, which should be organized in a truly inclusive setting without preconditions. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
In Kenya, wildlife authorities in the country have opened a new sanctuary for black rhinos in Tsavo East National Park. Black rhinos have fared better than other rhino species in recent years, but remain threatened by poachers who kill the animals for their horns. Rayerombur reports from Nairobi.
The Kenya Wildlife Service, working in collaboration with the Worldwide Fund for Nature, has moved 8 black rhinos from Nairobi National Park to Tsavo East National Park. 6 more black rhinos from Nakuru National Park are due to join them. If all goes well, the new sanctuary in Tsavo East will serve as a breeding ground for the black rhino species. Kenya Wildlife Service spokesperson Paul Kathitu says a lot of planning was done to ensure the rhinos are safe in the new habitat.
There has to be sufficient food, it has to be correct in terms of weather, in terms of water that is available. So all those factors had to be put in place, including even the issues of the security of the rhinos themselves. So all that put together, we felt that now the conditions were about right.
Rhino numbers have dropped dramatically in recent years, mainly due to poachers killing the animals to satisfy the black market for rhino horn. According to the non-profit Save the Rhino, more than 7,200 African rhinos have been lost to poaching during the past decade. On May 3rd, 3 black rhinos were found dead with their horns missing in Kenya's Meru National Park. Officials confirmed the deaths were the result of poaching. The new 100-square-kilometer rhino sanctuary in Tsavo East has a solar-powered electric fence designed to prevent poachers from entering the park. Kathitu says officials will keep close track of the rhinos.
1.5 years later, we just check to see have they increased, who has young ones, who is the auntie of who, and we keep some very, very individual records of each of those rhinos. They all have a name. They are all tagged so that we can be able to identify them individually. So we are hoping that we'll be able to build another big population to then contribute to the future building up of other sanctuaries.
Separately, scientists are hoping to rebuild the northern white rhino species. The last male of the species died in March of this year, and scientists are planning to artificially inseminate the 2 remaining females. But overall, rhino numbers in Kenya are on the rise. According to the Kenya Wildlife Service, at the end of 2017, Kenya had a rhino population of 1,258, including 745 black rhinos. The population has increased steadily since the 1980s, when Kenya was home to fewer than 400 of the animals. Railombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
A new report out from forest and water experts says that the role of forests is essential in solving water crises around the world. Mayn van Noordwijk from the World Agroforestry Center talks to Ricky Shryok about the relationship between rainfall in certain places, especially the Blue Nile area, and what happens to connected land such as the Congo Basin.
The issue of recycling of rainfall, that evapotranspiration from forest comes back as rainfall, that is a very old idea, but it was for a long time seen by scientists as playing a minor role. Over the Amazon, it has been quite well studied, but we think there's good evidence to think that most of the rainfall in the Blue Nile Basin, and on which Sudan and Egypt depend to a large degree, is recycled from the Congo Basin and from East Africa, coming in from Indian Ocean and Atlantic Ocean, and then going back to the atmosphere over Central Africa.
Does that mean that deforestation in the Congo Basin could lead to less rainfall in Sudan or along the Nile?
Yes, that's very much that's what we mean, essentially, yes. And we don't have concrete evidence yet how much it is, etc., but the relations are clearly there. It's very clear that the atmospheric moisture moves from Congo Basin and East Africa into the Sud and evaporates and comes back as rainfall over the Blue Nile Basin.
And has that decreased in recent years, that rainfall?
What we have seen, and that is some study from 3 rings in Ethiopia, where we have been able to go back 300 years in terms of the variation in how trees are growing and linking that back to rainfall. And that shows evidence that, yeah, the last decade, the rainfall has become even more variable than it was before. It has been variable for a long time, and we know even the Bible has the seven-year cycle of the floods and the droughts. But from the three rings, we get the strong impression that recently that variation is even increasing.
That was Mayne van Noordwijk from the World Agroforestry Center. He was speaking to VOA's Ricky Schreier from the Netherlands. It's now time for some World Cup news with Samson O'Malley as the FIFA 2018 World Cup tournament comes to a close. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson. We begin with the latest stories from the final day of the 2018 Summer World Cup, which ended on Sunday in Moscow, Russia. France won the FIFA World Cup for the second time after defeating Croatia 4-2 in a thrilling final in Moscow on Sunday. The French team took the lead in the 18th minute of the match at the Luzhniki Stadium following an own goal from Croatia's Mario Mandzukic. Croatia equalized through a fine strike from Ivan Perisic before French forward Antoine Griezmann scored a penalty shortly before halftime to make it 2-1. France extended its lead after the breakthrough goals from Manchester United midfielder Paul Pogba, a 19-year-old sensation Kylian Mbappe, before the forward Mandzukic netted a consolation goal for Croatia. It marks the second time that France has won the World Cup following its first title in 1998. The victory also meant that French coach Didier Deschamps became just the third man to win the competition as a player and coach. And reactions have been streaming in after France won the 2018 Summer World Cup. Croatian coach Zlatko Dalic insisted that his Croatian team produced their best performance of the World Cup despite losing 4-2 to France in the widely entertaining final in Moscow. After the match, Dalic pointed to the first half penalty decision as a key moment in the game, but was gracious in defeat. In the meantime, Croatia's Luka Modric has been named as the best player of the summer's World Cup after the Croatian star picked up the Golden Ball award. The Real Madrid midfielder ended up on the losing side in Sunday's final, but he was recognized for his contribution to his side's run to the showpiece, which included knockout victories over Denmark, Russia, and England. Belgium's Eden Hazard was second, and Antoine Griezmann, who lifted the World Cup trophy, was in third place. England's Harry Kane won the Golden Boot Award after finishing as the tournament's top scorer with 6, despite Gareth Southgate's side's semi-final defeat by Croatia. French duo of Antoine Griezmann and Kylian Mbappe finished on 4 goals, alongside Russia's Denis Cheshirev, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Eden Hazard. Belgium's Thibaut Courtois picked up the Golden Glove Award as the tournament's best goalkeeper, while Spain won the Fair Play Trophy, having gone out at the last 16 stage. And Mbappe, who scored in the final, won the award for the best young player of the tournament. France defender Adil Rami has announced his retirement from international football. He made a total of 35 appearances for France since his debut in 2010. Pussy Riot claimed responsibility for a group of protesters who took the field during the final World Cup match in Moscow on Sunday, indicating in a statement that the field invasion was staged to bring attention to political injustices in Russia. Minutes into the game's second half, 4 protesters dressed as policemen ran onto the field at Moscow's Luzhniki Stadium, interrupting play. That's the latest from the 2018 FIFA World Cup here in Russia. I am Samson O'Malley in Moscow. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July the 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. Thank you for spending this morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good week ahead, Africa.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Next on Let's Talk, swimming. This is next Monday at 7:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the upset-filled 2018 FIFA World Cup wraps up on Sunday. All five of the teams from Africa, Nigeria, Egypt, Senegal, Morocco and Tunisia were knocked out in the preliminary rounds. A discussion on the World Cup on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.